Doctor!
We're back, and it's about time you're with us on Pieces of Eight, the Doctor Who podcast that's tuned in to the Doctor that comes after that seventh incarnation.
Oh, that's very clever. I see what you did there. Yes, we're the podcast that looks at a different aspect of the Doctor Who universe, which features the incarnation of the Time Lord as played by Paul McGann. I'm Kenny Smith.
And I'm Rebecca Chapman. You join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen, in books, novellas, full cast audio, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, or anything else we can lay our eyes, ears, and hands upon. Head, shoulders, knees and toes.
Knees and toes. Or is it cheese and toast? Or is it beans and toast? Who knows? Everybody has their own local variation. I don't like beans.
Why do you not like beans?
I just don't particularly like them. If I can put barbecue sauce on them, they're not so bad, but I generally just don't like beans and the tomato sauce.
Have you tried them with Worcester sauce?
No.
Or Worcestershire sauce?
Oh, no, I haven't.
They're very good. If you just put like a splash of Worcestershire sauce in the pan whilst you're cooking them, they're very good.
No, oh, that's very easy for you to say Worcestershire. Some people struggle with that. Worcestershire.
Worcestershire.
No, we'll let that one go. Anyway.
Are we taking the mick out of our American friends?
No, not at all. Not at all. The American chefs, particularly Ree Drummond, the, what does she call herself? I nearly called her the Barefoot Contessa, but that's not her. She's the Pioneer Woman. The Pioneer Woman, that's who she is.
Yes.
She always likes going about her Worcestershire song. She can't say it. Anyway, talking of all things American, we're going to cross the Atlantic today to chat with John Sponsler, who was one of three people credited to work on the soundtrack of the Doctor Who TV movie, along with John Debney and Louis Fabre. Becca, are you a soundtrack fan?
I like soundtracks. I mean, it has to be something that I really enjoy. Like, I really enjoy Doctor Who soundtracks and like the odd musical soundtrack.
Yeah.
Although my thing at the moment seems to be rock covers of Disney songs.
Didn't see that coming.
No, it's nice. I like it. I'll have to send you some links later.
Please do.
There are some good ones.
Yeah, definitely. Bang them over, and I will whack him on. No, I've always been a big soundtrack fan. I mean, I think the Star Wars soundtrack was one of the first film soundtracks that I got many, many years ago. Or Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope, if you want to be a pedant about it. But to me, that first one always called Star Wars.
And, of course.
Because I'm old. And absolutely love it. Just the music of John Williams. And then later on, when I was at school, I learned to play the clarinet and tried to do part of the Cantina Band tune. I mean, who doesn't want to play that? That's cool. I mean, absolutely. I mean, when I was playing that, the girls were absolutely nowhere to be seen. So, yeah, that's why I stopped playing with my clarinet and gave up playing with my sax as well. So, yeah. Anyway, yes, other soundtracks. Yes, Doctor Who soundtracks were also a formative part of my youth. Doctor Who the Music and Doctor Who the Music 2, which were both packed full of synths from the Davison years. And then later got the 25th anniversary album with music from the McCoy years. And yeah, I've always been a big fan of Doctor Who and its soundtracks. And of course, the Doctor Who TV movie, which is such a good soundtrack, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It's fantastic. Quickly going back to what you said earlier about Star Wars 4 being the first Star Wars, does that mean that you do not appreciate Misa-Jaja Binks?
Misa no like a Jaja Binks. No, that's really bad.
That was terrible.
Yeah, no, my voice doesn't let me go that squeaky. No, I'm not a fan. I wrote a newspaper review when The Phantom Menace came out, and my review was called Jar Jar Stinks. So, there we go.
Anyway, without further ado, I feel like we should meet our guest today. It's time to welcome John Sponsler to Pieces of Eight. Sadly, I wasn't able to be here for this episode when you recorded it because I was at Dungeons & Dragons.
Yes, you were indeed. And I was able to get hold of John for an evening earlier this year, just after he and his family had recovered from a nasty bout of COVID. And I hate to tell you this, Becca, but he was lovely.
Oh, don't. It wasn't one of the sessions of Dungeons & Dragons where I died, was it?
No, it wasn't. It definitely wasn't. You were definitely alive. Yeah, we don't want to have you dying in a dungeon.
No.
Or eaten by a dragon.
No. And both of my deaths have been terrible. But anyway, put me out of my misery. Bring on our special guest.
My name is John Sponsler, and I'm a composer. I've been writing music my whole life, since I was 5 years old, and playing the piano, and I always wanted to embellish what I was supposed to play. So even my earliest teacher said to my mom, he doesn't like to play the notes on the page. He always wants to make his own. So I think it was always kind of in the cards for me to write music.
Well, welcome to the podcast. It's an absolute pleasure and honor to have you chatting with us. And I love the fact that you started your musical love so young. And what sort of things were you doing at that age? Were you just getting piano lessons and then just pretty much going off and improvising after that?
Yeah, piano lessons. My best friend at the time, his name was Michael Caldwell, and he was playing piano too. And we were both about 5 and 6. And so we'd play Heart and Soul for the family, and we'd like to jam together. And so, you know, and then as soon as I possibly could, I started putting bands together, getting neighborhood kids together and doing all of that.
Yeah. So what were your influences at that age? Are we talking sort of rock stuff? Are we talking more pop?
Honestly, it was the Partridge Family.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, I'm a little kid, right? So my dad came from a musical family. He played trumpet. And my mom's side of the family was also musical. And so that was my favorite show as a five-year-old. And I thought, well, we could be like the Partridge Family. You know, we could put a band together as a family. And that was my idea. And I remember my dad asked, you know, what instrument do you want to play? And I said, well, we've got two of them covered with you and mom, so why don't I play piano? And so that's how it all started with me. I always had the imagination of that music was a lot more than just what I was able to do on my own.
Yeah. So what instruments were they playing?
My dad was trumpet. My mom actually played the accordion. And in her family, there was guitar, zither, and an organ. So there was some kind of folksy stuff on her side.
Yeah.
But my dad was a pretty decent musician.
So I'd imagine that you'd have an interest in movie soundtracks and TV soundtracks as well. Because I think for all of us who, with a love of science fiction, you know, getting the John Williams Star Wars score, that's almost like a ritual, sort of everybody who loves their music at some point or other will get their Star Wars soundtrack.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, he's obviously an icon, and you know, you listen to John Williams and you know, more than half of you just wants to give up because he's just so amazing. The other half of you wakes up the next morning saying, okay, we're going to work harder at this. But you know, he was certainly an influence. I kind of grew up in the wanting to be in a prog rock band. So Yes and Genesis and Pink Floyd, those were kind of my influences growing up. But I was a little late for that whole scene. So by the time I got around to doing bands, you know, it was the 80s and then the early 90s. And that ship had kind of sailed and music had moved on. And so film music made a lot of sense to me for two reasons. One, I could never keep a band together. The drummer would always quit because he'd find a new girl somewhere. And it was so hard to find a decent singer. So I started buying a bunch of synths and 8-track recorders and things and just kind of doing it myself. And in prog rock, it's a lot of classical influence. And so there's a lot of that that influence that kind of lends itself naturally to instrumental music.
Interesting that you mentioned some of the bands there, that a British influence there on your musical tastes.
Well, I think anybody who's honest, right, that grew up in the era that I grew up had to have a huge British influence. You know, I mean, even the Beatles were just so revolutionary. You can still listen to Abbey Road and Sgt. Pepper today and you're thinking, yeah, how did they do this, especially then? Just phenomenal stuff.
Yep. So at school, were you studying music and did you go on and do that as a formal course?
I did. I studied music through college. In college, though, my senior year, there were really only two possibilities with a degree. One was to go off to a conservatory somewhere and play classical piano. And I wasn't disciplined enough for that. I wanted to write. And the other side was to keep getting degrees and be a teacher. And that wasn't going to work for me either. So I was living in a small town called San Bernardino at that time and going to the local university and decided that it was time for me to move to LA and give that a shot. And so I did. I moved to LA. I started producing songs for people with my little 8-track studio. I went to a school called the Grove School of Music, which was a Dick Grove was a real contemporary. and taught people how to arrange and to write for TV and songwriting classes and things that were far more interesting to me. So I did that while I kind of freelanced in bands and producing songs for people. And that's really kind of how I got things going.
Something that I noticed that as I hold up something that the listeners won't be able to see, I've got my Doctor Who TV movie original soundtrack issue, the very rare one to get hold of in Britain. And you did some fantastic sleeve notes talking about your influences and such like at the time and sort of how you built up your early portfolio.
Yes. Yeah, well, so Doctor Who, I don't know if people know this. This was my first professional scoring gig. And so I had been doing, producing songs and being in prog rock. And this was at the time when there was a big change in music from, pure orchestral kind of Jerry Goldsmith kind of style. And then, guys like Zimmer and Danny Elfman and James Newton Howard, they were doing some really fascinating things by combining contemporary elements and kind of doing this hybrid thing. And that was a word we use that's really tired today. But in the early 90s, that was kind of the emerging sound. And so I met John Debney, who obviously extremely talented composer, who was really fascinated with that genre. And that's what I brought to the table. I was great on the computers and the synths and producing and all of that. And of course, John was a terrific and established composer at the time. So he thought this would be a good pairing. And so, that was the reason for us to get together. And I worked with John on a number of films after this. But he, was so gracious to give me the chance and to give me the opportunity, really untested, and just kind of put me in here. And Doctor Who was kind of the perfect palette to take a guy, like me, and to say, let's look for something that's a little different, maybe a little bit off script. And I had a ton of ideas and a ton of music bursting in me. And so I kind of half was progressive rock keyboard player and the other half wannabe film composer. And so that was a lot of the influences, was just being free to kind of do what I wanted to do.
Yeah. How did you first meet the other John?
I had a good friend who was working for Gorfain and Schwartz at that time, was John's agent. And I had a good friend who was Sam Schwartz's assistant. And he was my college buddy. And so anyway, he took it upon himself to introduce me to a handful of guys. John Debney was one of them. Mark Mancina, who was working for Hans at the time, was another guy. And Mark Mancina did Speed, which was a score that was heavily influential, because as I listened to Jerry Goldsmith, I go, I may not be able to do that. But as I listened to Mark, I says, I get this vocabulary. I get this kind of hybrid, almost rock and roll meets orchestra kind of vocabulary. And that's what really inspired me to say, yeah, I think we can do this. So I met John and I met Mark at that time through my friend Ben Nichols.
Fantastic, because of course, Hans Zimmer has a connection to Doctor Who, which you may not know. Mm-hmm. Back in 1985, when the show was taken off air by the BBC for a wee while, they did a charity record to basically say, bring it back and put it on TV. It didn't do very well, but Hans Zimmer was just a young fellow just starting out in those days. And he worked in the studio on that. So there you go. There's a little bit of Doctor Who trivia.
Hans, he's had such an amazing career. His name pops up everywhere.
Yep.
I'm not surprised. I didn't know that though.
There we go. So another thing that I found fascinating from these sleeve notes was that you were a bit familiar with the original sort of series scores and the fact they were all synthesized. So were you familiar with the show before you started?
I was, being an American, we had Star Trek and the Brits had Doctor Who. And so it was something that at the time the producers, wanted to introduce to the American market. And so this movie was supposed to be a pilot for a TV series. And so in preparing for this, we looked at the previous Doctor Who's and obviously I'd been a Star Trek fan my whole life. And so this was a twist on that. And, sadly, it didn't seem that at that time the American market was ready for it because the series didn't get picked up. So we're left with this movie.
It must have been quite interesting for you just going in almost like with a professional ear, going back and listening to how they did it previously and then coming up with, as you said, working with John to come up with this new sound for the 90s.
And that was it. We didn't want to do what had been done. And, you know, this was 25 years ago. So the approach we took was very fresh at the time, and wanted to really kind of bring Doctor Who into the 90s and use some of these hybrid things. So, you know, one of the fun things for me, you know, I did the main titles with John. That was the first thing that we did. And we just wanted to kind of bring that up to date a little bit. But then once we got deeper into the score, you know, we did a lot of sound experimentation. John had created with a trombone this sound that we used for the master, and this kind of swooshy sound that is very signature throughout the score. And then when we got to the end, the whole open the eye sequence, that's where I kind of just cut loose with some of the progressive rock ideas. And I was able to use a pipe organ and a harpsichord and just these off instruments and this kind of classical gothic vocabulary that really seemed to work. I remember it's when I discovered the power of the parallel minor chord. And Louis Fabre was the other composer on this, who was really brilliant. And I learned so much from him. So we really did have a lot of fun. And there was a lot of different musical expressions. Louis and I kind of divided up the acts, and John was kind of the overseer guiding us along. So it was really, really great to work with both of these guys.
Yeah, because the thing that, I love the version of the theme that you did. And the thing that really fascinated me at the time was bringing the middle eight right to the start and just changing it around a wee bit. What was the thinking behind that?
You know, I can't remember exactly. I think that, you know, we wanted to, there was some narration, I remember, in the beginning. So we wanted to kind of get this kind of spacey, floaty, uncommitted thing that just kind of built intrigue and made you kind of lean in a little bit. And then I remember that, you know, we had talked about that the form, if we're going to reimagine this, then let's reimagine this, right? So let's, that means that we can invert the form, we can play with the form. There's no boundaries here. So I think we tried a number of different things. And when we finally started throwing images up against picture, this is the one that seemed to work the best.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's such an iconic soundtrack. I mean, like I said in the emails when we were chatting the other day, it's one that is genuinely up there as one of my favorite soundtracks of all time ever, with Star Wars. It's up there with Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Harry Potter stuff, and the John Barry Bond soundtracks, David Arnold's Tomorrow Never Dies. And I just think it's so iconic. And is it one that sort of sticks with you over the years? Anything particular that made you really proud that you think, yeah, I'm glad I did that?
Well, I think the scene I talked about, I think that whole rerouting the power, temporal orbit, you know, that, because here it's just like everything is just going wrong. There's chaos. And so by that time, we felt like we'd kind of earned the right to take off the gloves and not have any rules. And, you know, so that was very, very experimental. I think there are a number of ways we could have scored that traditionally, but it was really kind of, yeah, just be you and do what you think is. And so there was this thread of this little theme, this kind of gothic theme, this chordal minor chord gothic theme. And it just kept going and it kept kind of writing itself. I remember that. A lot of times we, as composers, labor over scenes, and sometimes it will end up being a good piece of music, but it's forced. This one just was very lyrical, is a word I can use. And as that scene kept evolving and things were getting more and more chaotic, the thread of this almost beautiful, gothic, classically influenced piece of music seemed to really work. And so we had a bigger scene to work with, and pieces like that need a little bit of space. So I love that the scene was long enough to be able to contain, you know, that full expression, that full idea.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that you're so young in your career, you get a soundtrack CD out there with your name on it. That must have been such a buzz.
It was. I remember, you know, my mom being so proud. And when it aired on TV, you know, I saw your name. And at that time, I had just started working with, or I just met my future business partner, Tom Geyer. And I remember he was watching it as well. And he was so impressed. This is the guy I just met, you know. So John, like I say, John was so gracious to give both, really, Louis and I. We both had careers that were really launched from this movie and this opportunity, and that he allowed us to be visible on that was just a really gracious effort on his part.
What do you recall about the first time that you saw the movie? Did you go to the premiere, or were you watching it at home?
John and I actually, I believe the very first time we did it, we saw a screening with the director, and we had to go down. I can't remember what studio it was, but John and I rode together, and we watched it there. And then I think we had a little bit of time, and I think John was doing, he was doing a couple of features at the time. So afterwards, we just went back to John's studio and just started riffing on ideas. And I remember taking a whole bunch of notes, and then I went my way, and he went working on his films. And then I came back with some ideas based on what we had discussed. And I remember just doing a lot of collaborative listening with John and refining these ideas. And so I can't remember when we actually got Picture, but it wasn't right away. So the first order of business was all about the theme, right? That was the only thing we wanted to tackle at first. So we had some time to really, you know, get that as good as we could get it.
You must have felt a bit of the fact you're working such a prestigious thing that's, you know, something that's known throughout the world and a BBC production, because I know from having spoken to quite a few friends in America who work in the TV and film industry, there's a little bit of extra, glitter attached to something that's got those three letters on it.
Yeah. Well, I was in awe of the whole thing, Kenny, you know, from first meeting John and getting this opportunity, still being, I think, in my late 20s or maybe really early 30s. So I was very green, and yet all of a sudden had this terrific opportunity that was well beyond what I should be doing at that point. And so, yeah, I remember being frightened and not sleeping a lot in those days.
It was
there was a lot of second guessing, and, you know, throughout our careers as composers, we're always second guessing everything we do. But I remember that being really escalated. I remember at the end of this, I was exhausted, because, you know, you can't let the franchise down. You can't let John down. He puts, you know, there's so much faith and opportunity being given to me, and I just didn't want to let anybody down. So I know that there was a lot of second guessing, and I even brought one of the guys, the bass player in my band at the time, in there to say, is this just the lamest idea you've ever heard, or is there some merit here? I need some objectivity. So yeah, there was a lot of that. There was a lot of that. And I think they were posting up in Canada. And I remember we were putting everything on D88 at that time. And I remember having to rush to FedEx to get, because I had to get it there by 5 o'clock, otherwise you'd miss it. And the one thing I was told is, don't ever miss a deadline, because you'll never get hired again. So I remember one time, and this is a true story, I literally left my car running in the middle of the street, because it was like at 4:55, and I ran in there to get the tape in the FedEx office so that it would make the shipment by that night. I didn't care if I got a ticket or what. I just was not going to miss a deadline.
Fantastic. I love it. And when do you recall seeing like the finished work? Was that, did you watch the premiere of that? Was that on TV with everyone else?
I think it was on TV. I don't remember a premiere. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty surreal, honestly, you know, because this was a TV movie of the week. Mm-hmm. This was back in the day where we didn't have tons and tons of cable and, you know, shows. So this was a network show. I believe they aired it on Fox. And it was a Fox movie of the week at the time. And so it was a big deal. This was primetime TV. And I just remember it being very surreal. The first time you hear anything that you've done outside your own studio is pretty satisfying, to be honest. You know, it's kind of what it's all about. You know, whether it's on the radio or in the movie theater or on TV, it was pretty surreal.
Yeah. I mean, I went to a midnight opening at one of our music stores here in Edinburgh. So I traveled 50 miles for this midnight opening. And there were tons of us from my friends, there must have been about 15, 20 of us queuing up at midnight to buy the VHS tape, and then went and watched it. And then we all reconvened in the pub on the following Monday, the 27th of May, 1996. It's stuck in my head. And we all watched it again, just so we're all together and had that more social thing. So it's, you know, it's something, it was a big deal for so many of us. And thank you very much for playing your part in it, because it's, the soundtrack is just blistering. As you probably gathered, I am a bit of a fan of it.
That's great. I think, you know, had we known how big a deal Doctor Who was overseas and to the rest of the world, it would have put even more pressure on us. And I think that there was a sense of, we know that this is, you know, it was introduced to me as this is the British Star Trek. And, you know, Star Trek had been around for a long time, but it wasn't exactly a thriving franchise in the 90s. And when we were doing this. And so, you know, I think if we had realized that in it now 25 years later, that this would mark some time in a greater story of Doctor Who, that probably would have put more pressure on us. And we may have broke, we may not have been able to contain that. So there was a certain bliss in the process of, you know, when you come to something and it's one of your first projects, you carry with it, you know, 30 years of ideas. And so that was the thing, is I had so many ideas. I wasn't sure they were the right ideas, but there was no shortage of ideas. And so that was really the freedom to kind of exist in our little studios and just talking with John and Lewis and really nobody else in the outside world. So what we were doing was in a very small setting. And now to look back on it, you know, it's kind of neat to see that there was a much bigger fan base than we were ever aware of.
I mean, if it had gone to series, would you have been interested in coming back and doing more?
Well, that was going to be it. You know, that was the plan, is that we would, the goal was to do the series. And so when it didn't get picked up, it was kind of a letdown, but we really had our hopes up that this would be the pilot, and that it would be picked up as a series, because we would have loved, Lewis and I would have done the score together, and, you know, under John, and that would have been just a great opportunity, because, you know, so much when you get into fantasy, again, the idea of anything is possible, anything can work, right? You're not confined genre wise because you're viewing things that are fantastic and otherworldly. And so what does that sound like? Well, nobody knows, because they've never been there. So you get to create that sound space. And that's a great style to work in.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier that after the TV movie, you worked with John Debney a bit more. Can you tell us about some of those projects?
We did a lot of, you know, from our perspective, the collaboration was a real success, because I brought something to the table that John wasn't doing, and John, you know, had everything else. And so we did, I think the next thing we did might've been Inspector Gadget together. And we did a bunch of fun family movies, which was perfect for me, because I was just starting my family at the time. Like Cats and Dogs, we did The Replacements. We did the Michael Jordan to the Max, and did a bunch of fun things. And it became part of my career at that point, was one third coming alongside John and helping produce some of the elements in his score. And then Louis Fabre, who was the other composer, was doing a lot of B movies at the time for a company called PM Entertainment. Well, Doctor Who kind of launched him off, and he was also working with John. And so I was introduced to this company. I started doing my own films. And then at the same time, I met my business partner today, and we started doing trailers. And so I had all these kind of things going on right after Doctor Who. So I was very busy, and really have been busy ever since.
Yeah. Could maybe tell us a wee bit about what you have been doing in the last few years for those who are interested, because I think anybody who's ever worked in Doctor Who, it means that there's an instant, the fan base are always like, oh, what have they been doing since? Because I'm sure that there'll be a lot of people who've had a look at your IMDb entries and things like that. But for those who haven't, if you could maybe tell us a few wee bits and bobs, that would be lovely.
Yeah. So, you know, doing my own projects. And then I had a series of years where I was fortunate enough to work with John Williams on Memoirs of a Geisha in Munich. And we did the Sunday Night Football theme with him. And that lent the opportunity to meet Hans. I'd worked with Hans's engineer Alan Meyerson on a trailer, I think, for The Last Samurai. And Hans was, in his words, looking for fresh meat for the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. So we came on board and did about 5 years working with Hans, did three or four of the pirate movies and Transformers and some of these other great films with Hans. All the while, my partner Tom Geyer and I had this trailer catalog that we had launched in the late 90s, like early 2000s. And the Hollywood scene at that time was very demanding, and we had young kids, and we had this kind of side project, which was our Brand X music library. And it was doing well, kind of in spite of our only paying about, you know, 40% attention to it as we were building our film career. So around 2011, we decided that we would no longer do scores in that manner, and that we would devote our time to build this. And so I've been focusing almost exclusively on that since 2011. And now we have a great team, and we have composers all over the world. So the Brand X Music Library, and so we license music, in promo movie trailers, and really all over the world. That's been great because we can work with musicians and orchestras, and there's so much talent out there. We've got one guy, from Kazakhstan, and they're going through so much political turmoil, and here it is. We've got this relationship with him, and we've got this voice from this part of the world, who's one of our best composers right now. And so it's really neat because we do work with people from really every continent.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I didn't realize, because obviously I've been in touch. I've seen that as your signature and email, but wow, that's incredible just to think that it's doing all that. Of course, back in the early 2000s, Doctor Who came back in TV. So was that something you were aware of and thinking, oh yes, I remember that?
I was. And there was, you can't help but think, because it did finally catch up and made it popular in the United States. And you can't help but think that, that could have been an opportunity for us to be more part of the whole franchise and a series and that portion of Doctor Who, which sadly is just represented in that one movie. So yes, there is a little bit of looking in your rearview mirror thinking, this came about 5 years too late.
But of course, renewed interest in your soundtrack work back in 2013 when it was reissued as part of a lovely, huge, big box set. In fact, it was in two. There was a small version of four discs with all the Doctors, and then there was one specifically dedicated, which had extra tracks that the original didn't have on it as well.
Oh, that's great. I wasn't even aware of that.
Oh,
I'll have to look that up. Yeah.
Yeah, it was issued in a great big wooden box. I think it cost about £100. It might have been more than that. And it was part of a box set with music from all 11 Doctors, as was the case then, in this beautiful wooden presentation kit. And it's even got a switch at the back. If you press it, the light flashes inside the TARDIS box. It's all there. And it's the complete version, whereas I think the previous release had been, there'd been a few tracks missed off. So it's just wonderful to have. And it must be something that, of course, you've worked in so many, as you say, so many incredible films and such like over the year, but to have just that wee line of a quaint old British TV series there on your resume, it must be something that you must be quite proud of.
It really is a great place to have had the opportunity, not only to work on it, but to really begin here. And I do think that it's incredible to be part of something that is so big and has a life. There's only a handful of franchises like that, that keep going, and there's new interpretations of it all the time, and yet it continues. All of them in their own right are very successful. Yeah. And so yes, to be a small part of that has been a real, real gift.
Yeah. And do you have any outstanding ambitions left still to do in your career? Because obviously you are very busy with keeping Brand X in the go.
The idea of providing a vehicle for young talent to have a road and to have that same opportunity or a similar opportunity that I was given is very satisfying. And so, we work with so many different musicians and composers from all over the world. So that is a really unique thing, because the demand for the kinds of music that we create in media, including video games and everything else, there's so much content out there, and all of that content needs music. And so we're constantly just amazed by the talent that is out there that maybe 10, 15 years ago, we would never be aware of because there would be no way to be connected. But now, in these days, through social media, that there is such an access to virtually every place in the world. And so, and we have a vehicle through Brand X Music to really, give those roads to those people, and their music is now being played on so many different media formats. And that's really neat.
I think music is just such an important part of our lives, whether we realize it or not, even if it's just in the background, just to have a beat playing. I know that I find it very hard to work in silence, so I like to have something on, even if it's low in the background, just so I've got something there. And it doesn't matter what it is, I just love my music.
It's great. That's also very gratifying, is when you get emails from people, or people blog on our social media about how they listen to Brand X and some things that we've done, or even Doctor Who, the soundtrack, people that you would never expect to hear from. And they're doing this because it inspires them as they're working out, or they're meditating, or they're studying, or so many different applications that the music was never written for specifically. And yet you realize that there are those people that are listening to something that you've done, and it's giving them something back. And so that's it. I always love to hear from those people.
Yeah. Well, I know every single last note, every drum beat on this, because as Steve, I've been listening to it virtually, 26 years almost since it came out. So yes, I love it. Every last flute, whistle, bell, the lot, and harpsichord, of course.
That's great. It's hard to believe 26 years ago.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem that long ago.
It doesn't. I have to say, I do notice you have got what looks like a rather impressive sound system behind you as we speak.
I do, and I'm remodeling, so I don't have my sound panels up. I can kind of give you a little tour here. So there's just a little coffee bar, and then there's just some posters of some films and some things. I got my piano there. It's a nice space.
Yeah, fantastic. John, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us. And if there's anybody out there who wants to find out more about Brand X, where should they go?
BrandXmusic.net.
There we go. As easy as that. John, thank you so much for your time.
Kenny, thank you so much. Take care.
There we go. That's our fourth guest who's worked in the TV movie. I wonder if we'll get anyone else. Let's see what the future holds.
I mean, there have been a few versions of the TV movie soundtrack, so...
Yes, that's true. I happen to own all of them, as you just heard when I said that to John. I've got the original release that came out in the 90s, which was a promotional... It says on it, for promotional use only, not licensed for public sale. And it was for Debney Productions, but for some reason these actually were on commercial sale. And I was able to buy it after my friend Darren Scott, the editor of SFX, tipped me off, because we were both big TV movie fans and loved the soundtrack. So I've got the original one. And then in 2013, as mentioned to John, it was re-released as part of an 11 Doctor set with a CD for each Doctor, beautifully presented, all inside one great big TARDIS box. And it's massive and it's really heavy. And I bought that with my first paycheck when I got my job back, as it was a very limited edition. But yeah, got that as well. Aww. And then there was a shorter version released on a four-disc 50th anniversary music compilation as well. So yeah, I do like that soundtrack. The fact that I paid for it three times. So there we go.
The way that you said that it wasn't available for promotion, it wasn't supposed to be available for sale.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, you know, when you go to a car boot sale and there's always that one man in a van who's like selling single cans of Coke or single bags of crisps out of a multi-pack.
Yes, that's so true.
Yeah, and you pick up like a can and it says not for individual resale, and you're like, am I breaking the law or is he? I'm concerned.
Well, you're not expected to look at the can every time you buy one. So yeah, he's the one. I think the fault would be on him, because he's therefore breaking trading standards laws. And if anybody actually does see these, please contact your local trading standards department. There we go. There's our public information useful service stuff done.
PSA, please be a snitch. Well, we're now underway with season 3 of Pieces of 8. And I'm sorry, Kenny, you've had to do most of the interview solo whilst I was unavailable with work.
I know, sorry. But this year, we're going to feature the Mary Shelley trilogy from Big Finish. Plus, of course, next week, we'll be kicking it all off with Mary's story. We're going to travel back to the worlds of the BBC Eighth Doctor novels with a couple of adventures and speak to the writers of those. And we've also got a Big Finish short trip in there, which we recorded last summer.
Ah, that's right. We mentioned that at Christmas as we featured the turn of the screw.
Yes, which is read by Yiji Cho, written by Eddie Robson, and produced by Ian Atkins. Incidentally, when I was in London last week on the 14th of February, I was in Forbidden Planet and bumped into Ian, who obviously produced the short trips while at Big Finish. And it was the first time I'd seen him in person in years. And he did send you his regards, incidentally, but I remember. So there we go.
Oh, that's very nice. But enough of you and your social life. I'm feeling really lonely here.
Oh.
Let's dematerialise for now, and we will be back next week as we start our adventures with Mary Shelley in bizarrely enough, Mary's story. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye. See you all next time.
Bye.